We continue now with the book by Father Paul O'Sullivan, All About the Angels. Chapter 5, When and Where Were the Angels Created? The angels were created at the same time the world was created, but before man. They were created in the state of grace and in the empyrean heaven, not in the heaven of the Blessed Trinity, not in the presence of God. Had they once seen God, they would never have ceased to see and love him. They were created, therefore, in another heaven, and here they had to give a proof of their fidelity to God and so merit the beatific vision. They, like us, have free wills, and like us had to choose between good and evil. True in the angelic nature itself, as St. Thomas teaches, there is no strife, as there is in our poor natures, between the spirit and the flesh, but before they were admitted to the beatific vision, they had to choose between their nature, already in the state of grace, and the still higher state of that grace, which would admit them to the immediate presence of God forever. No creature, however perfect, not even the princes of the angels, could see God without that most special grace which theologians call the light of glory. Before being admitted to see God, they were tried. In this trial, by far the greater number remained faithful to God and were immediately received into the heaven of the Blessed Trinity and allowed to gaze on the unveiled beauty of God. Once here, they could sin no more. Some of these, the faithful angels, always stand before God and are called the assisting angels. These are the seraphs, cherubs, and thrones. St. Thomas thinks that these never come on earth. Others, while always enjoying God's presence, ministered to us and are called the ministering angels. These are the dominations, virtues, and powers who guard the greater things of the universe and the principalities, archangels, and angels who give their care more especially to us. Unfortunately, many of the angels fell at the moment of trial. Some think as many as a third of the heavenly host. They fell through the sin of pride, preferring their own will to that of God in the time of trial. At the moment of their fall, they were precipitated into hell. Their great natures, their intellects and wills, retained their pristine strength and power, but their love and sanctity were transformed by their sin into implacable malice and hate. Seeing that they cannot attack God, they direct their fierce vengeance and vent their spleen on us, who are destined to fill the thrones they've left vacant, and enjoy the glory and happiness that they have forever forfeited. These angels fell, not all from one choir or other, but many fell from each choir. Some even of the highest and the holiest angels were lost. These are the demons, of whom we shall speak later on. Who will fill the thrones of the fallen angels? The thrones left vacant by the fall of these angels will be given to those of us who remain faithful to God and merit heaven. The question arises, who will fill the thrones of the seraphs and cherubs and other high angels who fell? Can men pretend to such high places in heaven? Yes, men also, men prepared by God with great graces and raised to the highest degree of sanctity, will take the thrones even of the great seraphs and cherubs who have fallen. Though it is true that our natures are immeasurably lower than those of the mighty princes of heaven, yet God raises up by his grace, which is a participation of his own divine nature, as St. Peter tells us, to be fully worthy of ranking even with the glorious seraphs who stand around his throne. Holy Mary, God's dear mother, queen of angels and saints, is an example of this. She is holier and greater than all the angels. She's on a plane all by herself, inferior to God, but incomparably superior to all other creatures. Even at the first moment of her existence, she was greater and holier than the highest angels. Saint Joseph, the foster father of Jesus, and the most pure spouse of Mary, comes next. Next, we may believe, rank the apostles, patriarchs, and prophets. Many, too, of the other great saints, like Saint Dominic, Saint Francis, Saint Ignatius, will doubtless fill glorious thrones near God. We read in the story of the Blessed Jordan, who succeeded Saint Dominic as Master General of the Dominican Order, that after his death, God was pleased to manifest his sanctity in diverse ways. He himself appeared to St. Ludwine and others, telling them of his special glory in heaven, and saying that he ranked with the prophets and the apostles. St. Paul, too, the first hermit who had dwelt in the desert from the age of 16 until the age of 115, was also seen after death by St. Anthony, being carried to heaven by the angels and given a place among the prophets and apostles. A pious author relates the legend of how once a holy man was shown in vision the glory of heaven. He noted one high throne that was vacant and asked the angel who accompanied him, "Whose throne is that?" The angel made answer, "That was the throne destined for Lucifer, but now Francis of Assisi will fill it." The mighty Lucifer fell through pride. The lowly Francis has been raised up by humility. Chapter 6, Our Angel Guardians. We will now speak of what is for us the most interesting and important of all the facts concerning the angels, namely, their role as our dearest, most intimate, most loving guardians. Every Christian should strive to have a full comprehension of this doctrine and should realize vividly the presence of this angel by his side. When does our angel begin to take charge of us? The great St. Thomas tells us that the moment a child is born, God calls one of his glorious spirit and gives the newborn babe into his special care. It is not when the soul is created and united to our bodies, which takes place before our birth, for then the child is still one with its mother and protected by the mother's angel. But it is when we are born into the world that our angel begins his care of us, even before baptism. Every man, whether pagan, heretic, or Catholic, has a guardian angel. Though one angel would be powerful enough to take perfect care of 1,000 souls, yet God, in his infinite goodness, has given to each one of us a special angel, an angel who is all our own, whose great duty henceforth will be to watch over us day and night, asleep or awake, alone or in the midst of company, in our homes, in the street, working or resting, everywhere, every moment of our lives, in joys and in troubles. He never abandons us for a single instant. He sees our every movement. He's ever at our sides. Each one has a special angel. It seems at first sight incredible that God gives each one of us poor mortals a glorious Prince of Heaven to guide and guard us all the days of our life, who's with us night and day, who devotes all his time, all his care, all his unceasing vigilance to secure our happiness. But in pure truth, it's only one of the many immense proofs of love which our dear Lord has given us. What personal favors has not God himself already done us? Did he not create us with his own hands, making us to his own image and likeness? Did he not raise us up to the highest possible destiny that he could give us, namely to be with him as his dear children forever in heaven, seated on thrones in his presence, enjoying infinite joys, the most perfect happiness for all eternity? Is he not our Father? Did he not suffer and die for each one of us? Does he not come into our souls, uniting himself to us most intimately, countless times in Holy Communion? Does he not watch over us every moment, so that not a single hair falls from our heads without his permission? True, indeed, it is a wonderful proof of his love to give us a special angel all to ourselves, to be our friend and protector. But it is only in keeping with what he's already done for us, and it is to prepare us for what he still wishes to do for us. But what is really amazing is that we do not appreciate, do not understand as we ought this divine favor, that we do not prize and love and seek to know better this glorious angel who is so good to us. Our neglect of our dear angel is appalling. What does our angel do for us? We've already explained the great holiness, power, and love of the angels, how mighty their intellects are, how powerful their wills, and how irresistible their strength. Now, when an angel takes charge of a soul, he devotes all his glorious intelligence and knowledge, all his power and vigilance, to protect, defend, and help in every possible way the person whom God has given into his charge. He does this firstly because God gives him the command to do so, and the angels most earnestly desire to do what God wishes. Secondly, because he has himself an immense, personal, affectionate love for us. He longs to share with us his joy, his happiness, his love, his holiness, and this with such a generosity and earnestness of desire as we selfish mortals cannot possibly understand. He labors every moment, day and night, to make us better, holier, and happier. Not satisfied with his own efforts on our behalf, he prays for us unceasingly and with incredible fervor to God. What would we not give to have certainty of the prayers of a great saint like Saint Dominic, Saint Francis, or Saint Ignatius? But we have those of an angel, burning with the love of God and full of intense love for us, interceding constantly for us before the throne of the Most High. God can refuse him nothing that he asks for his client, since it was God who gave him charge over us and ordered him to take every care of us. This great angel, too, is constantly whispering into our ears counsels full of love and wisdom. Our angel may not interfere with our free will, but he can and does act on our memories, recalling vividly something we ought to do or warning us of something we ought not to do. He acts benevolently on our imaginations and on our reason, persuading us, urging us to correct our weaknesses, to fight against our evil inclinations, inspiring us with new ideals, and stimulating us to a fresh and greater effort. If we do wrong, he's angry. He's ever on the alert to defend us from the fierce attacks of the demons, who are our relentless foes, and who use all their malice to ruin us, to tempt us, to make us sin, and who stir up every sort of trouble against us. Our angels, moreover, save us from many other dangers and evils of which we're utterly unconscious. Only in heaven shall we come to know the favors and benefits that our angel confers on us every day, the sorrows from which he saves us, the perils from which he snatches us. It could not be otherwise, since he's devoting to us all his angelic vigilance, all his bright intelligence. His efforts on our behalf are unceasing. On marriage, the angels most especially give us help in the important events of our lives. The great bulk of men and women are called to the married state. There's nothing more vitally important for them than a happy marriage, nothing that ruins and wrecks their lives like an unhappy marriage. Now the dear angels are more eager than their clients should obtain this great grace than father or mother or even than themselves. What happy marriages would there not be if only young men and women earnestly besought their angels to obtain this blessing for them? Those, therefore, who desire a happy marriage should earnestly pray to their angel for this grace. No one better than he can secure this blessing for them. We read how Saint Raphael obtained for Tobias a beautiful, virtuous, and wealthy spouse. Our angel can do the same for us. Another all-important fact in our lives is suffering. All must suffer, but suffering is easy to bear if only we know how to suffer, and if we have a clever nurse and an able doctor to help us when we're sick, and we have a kind friend who can help and console us in other troubles. Again, our angels are all-powerful to help us in sickness and suffering. We shall see later on how the angels help the martyrs to bear even with joy in their cruel torments. Much more can our angels help us to bear our little sufferings. How many sufferers in their own homes, and still more in hospitals, are condemned to spend days and weeks on beds of pain and pass long, interminable nights of wakefulness and agony? What help and consolation they could have if only they knew and loved their dear angels and called on them constantly for help, as we saw in the case of St. Gemma Kelgani. It is indeed criminal to neglect to teach boys and girls all about the angels, for thus they are deprived during all their lives of the greatest blessings. Examinations have much to say in the future happiness and welfare of boys and girls. No professor, howsoever clever he may be, can impart knowledge like our angels if only we ask them. Students who are devout to their angels will study with far greater ease and will make far more brilliant examinations than others. Their angels will give them a love and passion for study, which is the best guarantee for acquiring knowledge. We have frequently to embark on important business arrangements, which may bring us much gain or much loss. There are doubts and difficulties which we cannot resolve. Once more, our best counselor is our great angel. Let us appeal to him for help and advice. Chapter 7. Is it by mere chance, or is it our angel? We often hear the words, "I had a miraculous escape," "I escaped by a hair's breadth." But in plain truth, how did we escape? It was most probably our angel who snatched us from the danger that threatened us. Again, we hear of someone who's dying, of whose life there is no hope, and who suddenly takes a change for the better and gets well. The watchers by the bedside cannot understand how it happened. Neither can the doctors see the reason for the change. Was it mere chance? Certainly not. It was his dear angel, who is all-powerful, all-loving, who intervened and saved him from a premature end. An angel knows more about medicine and sickness than all the doctors in the world. It is true that we cannot affirm categorically that this or that was done by the angel if we have no proof of it, but we can say much more, that our angel saves us from thousands of dangers and evils, and that he confers untold benefits and favors on us, and that at every moment of our lives. It is for that and for that alone that he's standing by our sides, that he's watching over us with all his vigilant care. Many times we ourselves prevent him using his loving power on our behalf because we refuse to listen to his inspirations and counsels, clinging obstinately to our evil ways, to our silly imaginings. Some instances. Were a person of delicate health rich enough to retain an eminent physician constantly in attendance on him, with instructions to use all his talent, to bestow all his time, and to spare no expense in order to secure the improvement of his client's health, the patient would certainly attribute any betterment in his state to the unceasing care and efforts of his doctor. Yet the most eminent doctors have not the knowledge, the experience, the skill, the ability, the unrelaxing care, the eager wish to help us that our angel has. Why then hesitate to attribute the many extraordinarily good things that happen to us to this ever-watchful angel? Or take the case that's occurring daily in every household of the world. Children, young and full of life, giddy, of course, and possessing little sense or prudence, are given into the watchful care of a nurse, whose only task is to take care of the little ones and see that no harm comes to them. She's nothing else to do. No one doubts that this vigilant attendant saves her charges from a thousand dangers. They may walk in streets busy with traffic, where cars, automobiles, conveyances of all kinds constantly pass, or they may walk by the side of a lake or a fast-flowing river or on a road which borders on precipices, but they are safe. Why? Their nurse is vigilant. She keeps them from all dangers. Yet the watchfulness of a nurse is only a faint image of the unceasing care and vigilance of a mighty angel. Interesting facts. A lady friend of the writer's was once traveling with her little boy of 3 years of age in an express train. The child was standing near the door of the carriage, which suddenly flew open. It had not been well closed. The boy was flung out. The mother, frantic with terror and filled with the gravest fears for the life of the little one, pulled the safety cord. But the train, which was traveling at high speed, did not pull up for a considerable time. When the rescue party reached the spot where the child had fallen, instead of finding a broken and bruised little body as they expected, they found the cause of their anxiety unscathed, radiant with happiness, playing as if he were in his nursery at home. The thought of all was, it was surely God's angel who saved that child. On another occasion, a young friend wishing to scale a high wall placed a ladder against it and proceeded to mount. At some yards from the wall, there was a deep well, about 6 feet in diameter, which had its sides paved from the top to the surface of the water with great stones. Suddenly, the climber found himself at the bottom of the well, standing up, unscathed. How did this happen? The ladder must have slipped in some strange way. In the natural course of events, he would have dashed his head against the side of the well, or fallen head foremost into the water. But except for the wetting, he escaped without the smallest scratch or bruise. He could only think that it was his dear angel who saved him from a horrible death, so that every day he thanks his angel with all his heart for this favor. A lady and her daughter were walking together on a road on the side of which was a high wall. Suddenly, the young girl stopped. Her mother repeatedly called her to come on, but she didn't move. A moment afterwards, the high wall crumbled and fell with an awful crash, and would have certainly killed both mother and daughter had they gone only a few steps further. The mother, astonished at what had taken place, asked her daughter why she had stopped so suddenly, and as it proved, so opportunely. "Oh, mother," exclaimed the girl in surprise, "did you not see that young man who signaled to me not to go on? Was it her angel?" The writer once asked a venerable bishop with whom he was traveling in a motor car through a crowded city if he was afraid of accidents, as a little time before some serious collisions had taken place. "Oh, no," he replied, "when I get into a motor car, I at once place myself under the care of my angel guardian, and I feel quite safe." A young lady who lived in a lone countryside once assured the writer that she was never afraid, neither in daytime nor in the darkest night, because she felt absolutely sure that she had her angel with her, an angel who loved her, an angel all-powerful, ready to help her. When anything happened amiss, and she escaped unhurt, she instinctively thanked her angel, for she knew full well that it was he who had kept her from harm. Another told him that she had in her early life been very nervous and fearful, but on learning about the angel guardians, she was filled with boundless confidence in her angel, so that she now enjoys perfect peace and is no longer tormented with those horrible fears. The conduct of these two ladies should be the attitude of every good Christian. Michael's guardian angel. The following interesting fact bears, as our readers will see for themselves, the impress of truth. It happened some 30 years ago, but the account has been reprinted several times with the personal guarantee of those who were actually present at the time of the occurrence. In a small town in Pennsylvania, the parish priest, with the help of some nuns, was preparing the boys and girls of the parish for confirmation. On the eve of the ceremony, the children were taken to the church to make their confessions. One of the sisters in attendance got annoyed at what she considered the unusual giddiness of the children. She noticed them whispering to each other and looking all in one direction, apparently at one of their companions, a little boy of 10 or 12, and she bade them to be recollected. On returning to the school after the confessions were over, she again reminded them that in church they must refrain from talking and whispering to each other. To her amazement, the children told her that they had seen an angel and were quite surprised that she had not seen him too. The tone of innocence and sincerity, and at the same time the unanimity with which all positively asserted that they had seen the angel, impressed the good nun. In fact, there seemed to be no possible doubt of what they affirmed. However, to make things still more certain and clear, she called them aside separately and diligently questioned each one as to what he or she had seen, when exactly they first saw the angel, where, and what he was like. Once more, the children described, each separately, exactly what they'd seen, and with perfect agreement as to details. It was as follows. One of their number, Michael, who was an excellent lad, had gone in his turn to confession. On leaving the confessional, the children, one and all, saw a beautiful angel, spotlessly white and radiantly beautiful, accompanying Michael, first to the altar where he knelt, and then to his place in the benches. The angel had its wings outstretched and had an expression of tender love as it looked at Michael. At once the children, taken by surprise, whispered, "Look, look, oh, how lovely!" The nun, more than ever convinced of the truth of what the children told her, hastened to lay the facts before the priests. These discussed the matter among themselves, and then, without awakening the suspicions of the children, proceeded also to question them. They, in their turn, were deeply impressed, and saw no reason for doubting what the children stated so firmly. His lordship the bishop arrived in the course of the evening, and the priest gave him a full account of this consoling incident. He also wished to have first-hand evidence, and once more, the children, unwaveringly, narrated to his lordship all the facts as before. Inquiring into Michael's behavior, he learned that he was indeed a very good and innocent boy. He was cheerful and gay, a good companion, a diligent student, and although he lived very far from the church, he attended the instructions regularly and learned his lessons with unfailing care and diligence. The bishop, the priests, and the nuns were convinced that Michael's guardian angel had indeed manifested his presence. Chapter 8. In the book All About Angels. The Angels in the Sacred Scriptures. The Angels in the Old Testament. We find the most complete references to the angels and proofs of their touching love for us in that best and purest of all sources, the Sacred Scriptures. We shall therefore select a few of these beautiful stories, and we invite our readers to ponder on them and learn the lessons they teach. They may have read them before, but they can never drink too deeply and too often of these living waters, which are the Word of God. An Angel Comforts Agar. We read of how a glorious angel appeared to Agar when she was plunged in grief and despair in the desert, seeing her son about to die a cruel death from hunger and thirst. The angel, full of love, consoled and comforted the sorrowing mother. He not only gave her abundance of water for herself and her son, but he filled her with great joy by assuring her that her son would become the father of a mighty race. Every mother has a dear angel guardian by her side, and each of her children has one also. When children are sick, or when they cause their parents sorrow and anxiety, these mothers should remember to appeal to their holy angels for help and consolation. One of the gravest duties of every Christian mother is to instill into the minds of her children respect and love for their angels, to give them a full and clear comprehension of the presence of their angel guardians. An angel comes to the help of Elias. In like manner, one of these loving spirits came to the aid of the prophet Elias when he was flying from Queen Jezebel, who sought to take his life. The prophet was worn out with sorrow and fatigue, and in the depths of his grief, he lay down under the shade of a tree and besought God to allow him to die. Exhausted, he fell fast asleep. God's dear angel presently came and roused him from his slumber and gave him delicious bread to eat and heaven-sent water to slake his burning thirst. The prophet, refreshed and invigorated by the food the angel had given him, once more fell into a peaceful sleep. When he had rested sufficiently, the angel once more awoke him and bade him eat and drink again of what the Lord had sent him, for he added, "A long journey still lies before you." Renewed in body and soul by the angel's ministrations, the prophet now walked for 40 days and 40 nights in the strength of this angelic food, finally reaching the goal he had set before him, namely the Mount of Horeb. Let us learn from this angelic intervention a lesson which will serve us in our every need, namely that our dear angel guardian, who is ever at our side, loves us with an unbounded love. And though he may not show himself visibly to us as he did to the prophet, still he is nonetheless really with us, and nonetheless eager and ready to help us if we only call on him. We must clearly recognize the fact that we have an angel ever with us night and day, able and willing to comfort us in all our needs. Judith, with the help of an angel, saves her people. Judith of Bethulia furnishes us with another interesting story of angelic help. Judith was a very beautiful and pious widow. Her native city of Bethulia was besieged by Holofernes at the head of the Assyrian army. The natives of the city were reduced to extremities by fast increasing want of food and drink, for the enemy had completely cut off the water on which the city depended for its supplies. The unhappy rulers were already negotiating the surrender of the city into the hands of the enemy, when this heroic woman, full of righteous indignation, rebuked them for their want of trust in God, and determined to save the people herself. With a holy daring, she sought and obtained permission to leave the city, and with the gravest risk to her life and honor, determined to penetrate into the camp of the enemy, even into the very tent of Holofernes. Dressing herself in costly garments, the better to gain favor with Holofernes, and taking with her a single maid, she fearlessly left the safety of the city and made her way at nightfall into the hostile camp. She was speedily seized by the enemy soldiers, but with an unexampled bravery, calmly demanded of her captors to lead her to the presence of their chief, which they readily did, believing that she had a secret of great weight to impart to them. She succeeded, as she had hoped, in winning favor with Holofernes, and biding her time until he, drunk with wine, lay on his bed in deep sleep, she then drew his sword from its scabbard and with two mighty blows severed his head from his body. Placing her bloody trophy in a bag under cover of night, she returned to the gates of Bethulia and from afar cried to the watchmen on the walls to open the gates, for she said, "God is with us, who has shown his power in Israel." Well, great was the surprise and the joy of the rulers and priests when, taking the still bleeding head of her victim from her bag, she held it up to their astonished gaze. Their lives, their city, and the people were saved. "Hang," she said, "the head of Holofernes on the walls, and as soon as the sun shall rise, let every man take his arms and rush out to the assault, and when you see that the enemy is fleeing, go after them without fear, for the Lord will destroy them under your feet." The rulers followed this sage advice. Taken by surprise at this unexpected attack by the Jews, the Assyrians sought to rouse their sleeping general, but alas, to their consternation and dismay, they only found his headless body, and seized with panic, they broke into wild flight. The rout was complete. The pursuing Jews made a great slaughter and possessed themselves of a mighty booty. 30 days were scarcely sufficient to gather the immense spoils. Mindful of the brave woman, who at such imminent peril to herself had saved the city from destruction, and their wives and children from the vilest of slaveries, the people sang her praises in immortal canticles, which have glorified her name for all time. Joachim, the high priest, came from Jerusalem to Bethulia with all his ancients to see Judith. And when they had come, they blessed her as with one voice, "Thou art the glory of Jerusalem, thou art the joy of Israel, thou art the honor of our peoples." Now, we may ask, who helped this weak woman to carry out a plan so daring that even the bravest soldier would have hesitated and feared to undertake? She herself tells us that it was her holy angel. "God's angel has been my keeper, both going hence and abiding there and returning thence hither. And the Lord hath not suffered his handmaid to be defiled, but rather brought me back to you without pollution of sin, rejoicing for his victory, my escape, and your deliverance." Once more, learn from Judith to place unbounded trust in our angel guardian. Heliodorus, punished by the angels. In the history of Heliodorus, we have a striking proof of how God comes to the aid of those who trust him, and how he punishes his enemies. The king of Syria, being in urgent need of money, and hearing that there was much treasure in the temple of Jerusalem, sent one of his trusty officers, named Heliodorus, to seize these treasures. On his arrival in the holy city, the king's messenger announced the object of his coming. The high priest warned him that he dare not touch this money or profane the temple. The royal envoy made no account of the prayers of the priest and the protests of the people, but proceeded to carry out the orders of his master. The priests prostrated themselves before the altar, clad in their sacerdotal vestments, And so great was the grief and anguish depicted on the face of the high priest that all were moved to pity and compassion. Many, too, came from their houses praying and making public supplication to God for help in their great need. Women and young maidens raised their hands to heaven and implored God's all-powerful protection. Heliodorus, intent on carrying out the orders of the king, boldly entered the treasury with his retinue when, lo, a horse with a terrible rider on it, clad in golden armor, ran at him fiercely and struck him with its forefeet, while two young men, beautiful and strong, bright and glorious, in comely apparel, stood at either side of him and scourged him severely with rods until he fell fainting to the ground. His attendants lifted him up speechless and half dead. They placed him on a litter and carried him out without any hope of recovery. Filled with a holy fear and dread, they then besought the high priest to make intercession to the Most High, that his life might be spared, and that he might return in safety to their king. And this the high priest consented to do, and while he was praying, the same angel again appeared and said to Heliodorus, "Give thanks to Onias, the high priest, because for his sake the Lord has granted thee life." Heliodorus, repentant and full of gratitude, offered sacrifice to God and made vows to him who had granted him his life. He also gave thanks to Onias. Then, taking his troops, he returned to the king and testified to all men the works of the great God which he had seen with his own eyes. When the king, still desiring to seize the treasures of the temple, asked him who might be a fit person to send again for that purpose, he answered fearlessly, "If thou, O king, hast an enemy or traitor to thy kingdom, send him, and thou shalt receive him again scourged, if indeed he escape at all, for there is in that place certain power of God." It is thus that God sent his angels to protect his friends and punish his enemies. Now that there's so much unrest and trouble in the world, all Christians should pray to the holy angels for help. If we do so, they will save us, as they saved the temple of Jerusalem. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are cast into a fiery furnace and are saved by an angel. Nebuchadnezzar, the all-powerful king of Babylon, built a golden statue 60 cubits high and demanded all his subjects to adore it under pain of being cast into a fiery furnace. Three Hebrew youths refused to obey and bravely told the king that their God could deliver them from his hands. The king, in a great fury, ordered the furnace to be prepared and heated 7 times more than was usual, and commanded that the youth should be bound and cast into the flames. The king's servants continued to heat the furnace with brimstone, pitch, and dry sticks, but the fire did not even touch the holy youths, for an angel came and stood by them, so that they walked in the midst of the dreadful fire, praising and blessing God, whereas those who cast them in were caught by the flames and burned alive. The king was astonished and exclaimed, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire, and I see 4 loose and walking in the midst of the flames, and there is no hurt in them, and the form of the 4th is like the Son of God?" This was the angel God sent to help the holy youths. He ordered the young men to come forth, and when they did so, he and his nobles saw that not even a hair of their heads had been touched by the fire. Then the king broke forth in praise of the true God and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who had trusted in him. There is no other God who can save in this manner." Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel, hated by his enemies who were jealous of him, was accused by them to King Darius for disobeying the orders he had given to adore a false god. The king, though he loved Daniel, was constrained by these wicked men to cast him into the lion's den, for such was the law of the Medes. No time was lost. Daniel was seized and thrown to the hungry lions. Darius, full of bitter grief, could neither eat nor sleep that night. Rising early in the morning, he hastened to the den of the lions, and calling out, asked Daniel if God had saved him. Daniel answered, "My God hath sent his angel, and hath shut up the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me." The king then ordered him to be released, and his enemies to be thrown to the lions. These had not well reached the bottom of the den before the lions caught and devoured them. Then the king Darius wrote to all his people and said, "It is decreed by me that in all my empire and kingdom all men dread and fear the God of Daniel, for he is the living and eternal God." Once more, we see how God never fails his servants, but sends his holy angels to take charge of them if they call on him. We will continue with the booklet All About the Angels by Father Paul O'Sullivan on side B of this tape.